That's also so far off from what I'm actually doing that I wouldn't be the person to do it, even if I had the resources. So I would probably rather move to the Caribbean with infinite resources. No, I think two things that I find very exciting for the nearer future that are more realistic and maybe more in my ballpark. One is, and she was the one to motivate me and keep me up with it. So we certainly owe to Andrea as well to keep it alive at the time. Oh my God, that's the same tract that Carlos just published, but it's from a different target. So the OCD story there. We thought, okay. Now the reviewer put into our mouth exactly what we already think. Now we have the liberty to actually put it in at scale, and we changed a lot of the narrative in the introduction and said, these functional circuits can potentially be identified
Welcome to Stimulating Brains.
All right, everyone, welcome to episode number 50 of Stimulating Brains. For today's episode, we have a really unique guest, Dr. Andreas Horn, who's an associate professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. He's the director of connectomic DBS research in the Center for Brain Circuit Therapeutics at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and then holds the same title, director of connectomic DBS research at Mass General Hospital in the Department of Neurosurgery. And so it's my honor to be interviewing Dr. Andreas Horn. Well, I am very, very honored to welcome listeners to, I believe it's the 50th episode of the Stimulating Brains podcast. And I've been a big fan of the podcast since its origin and have been extremely impressed with the set of speakers that you've invited, that you've gotten on the podcast, and wanted to flip the microphone. And there's one world expert in brain stimulation that has failed to be interviewed on Stimulating Brains, and that is Andy Horn himself.
Thank you,
and
Mike.
So I have this great, great honor of interviewing Andy today about his career, but then also about the Stimulating Brains podcast itself and what you've learned over the last 50 episodes from some of the world's experts.
Thank you so much for doing this. I think, it's a fantastic idea. Although when I started this, I really did not want to make it at all about myself, but there were, I think, several people along the way that have requested this. And then I think we can at least try. So thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Yeah, no, very excited. So, following your model of how you started all the other Stimulating Brains podcasts, we'll start with non-science.
Yeah.
And hobbies and what do you like to do when you're not stimulating brains?
Yeah, great question. So I often remember these days a podcast that you were interviewed in. I think it's called People Behind the Sciences, and you were a bit younger and your kids were three and something around that. And you said something like the kids are a big inspiration to you, how they problem solve and so on. And I really feel that a lot these days too. So my kids are still a bit younger, 2 years and 2 months essentially. And but they are a lot of fun. And I take a lot of joy, see how they grow and so on. And then I guess since kids are always the standard answer for many people, I wanted to say one more thing, that music has been a big hobby in my life, and I don't think many people know that.
Oh, what do you actually play?
So I've actually went, it was all a bit more 10 years ago, but I did even play on stage and even on TV once and in the radio and so on. So I
What instrument?
I was frontman and sang and also played guitar in multiple band projects throughout, I think, at least a decade. And I never formally quit this hobby, but it's on ice in a way because I lack the time, and I sometimes still play some music, but I love the recording part, writing songs and all these things. So yeah, I guess that's
Oh, you're in trouble now. It's not going to be on ice anymore. I expect a guitar and singing event sometime soon.
Well, I really probably couldn't anymore, but there's stuff on Apple Music and Spotify and so on, so old stuff.
All right, so for listeners, stay tuned, because the Stimulating Brains intro song will be changing in the near future to be written in Sanguine. I don't want to put the pressure on you.
Like, I mean, the point there for that intro song, that's from a good friend of mine from that time. So it's not my music jingle, but it's from a good friend that I also played in bands with and so on. So.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that. The intro jingle is actually
the jingle thing.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
There's
all
a
right.
full song towards that. I can maybe also...
With vocals?
Not vocals, that one. Yeah. But the song is called Die Maschine Mensch, which means the machine human. And I found that kind of fitting to the podcast also thematically.
Oh, I love it. Oh, so we just need to write lyrics for
yeah,
the...
yeah.
So I have a long list of questions of my own, but we also got questions from some of the people that you've interviewed
Wow.
On the podcast. And it was interesting. A lot of the people that wrote in actually had questions about, you know, your background or even growing up. And so the honor of the first question doesn't go to me, but goes to Nico Dosenbach,
okay.
who actually wanted to know how you liked growing up in a small town in southwest Germany on the Rhine River.
Yeah, I think we share that with Nico, and he got to tell his story. But I think my town wasn't that small. I think his town was really a village, and mine 40,000 inhabitants or so. So it's not that small. But it was fun. It's a lovely place in Germany. You know, it's at the border of France and Switzerland. So they sometimes call it the three country corner or something. So, you know, French wine is close by, but also Switzerland is not far. So and then it's a Black Forest region. So I love that. I kind of, you know, growing up in a small city, I think I was a bit late to the game of then discovering the world in a way. I never felt like I had to go places to be happy, and studied in the closest university town, which is Freiburg. It's a good university, but it's, you know, it already shows that I did not really want to leave home much. But then I did a year in Madrid as an Erasmus during med school, and I think that was the first time in a big city to actually live in a big city. And then my friends all wanted to move to Berlin, and so then, you know, discovered that I really did not want to move there, but they dragged me there in a way. And so that way, I think, and it's funny that, for example, my brother, who's an eye doctor now in that same town, he was the guy that between two of us that always wanted to go to the world. And, you know, he studied in Munich. He did the USMLE even. He wanted to go to the US to come practice here. And so now it's a bit reversed that he's back home and I'm here. But yeah.
And then before we get into your career, another really cool question that got sent in was Michael Oaken wants to know, growing up, what's the best story of trouble that you got into in Germany?
Oh my, trouble. I was not such a troublemaker, I fear. That was, I mean, it was an accident, but it was actual trouble at the moment. So it was the 1st of May, which in Germany is a holiday. So, you know, people usually go outside and do walks and hikes and so on. But we were nerds and played music. We were at the band room, and that was in a big factory of the bassist's father. So we had a room in there that we could use. And then he sometimes went into the industry, to the factory hall, and drove a forklift around, and
so this is your father.
So no, it was the father of the bass player of the band.
Oh, I see.
That
so
owned
your
that
friend's
factory.
Father.
Yeah, friend's father. And so we were alone. Everybody was outside, you know, enjoying the sun. We were inside playing music, and then I drove that forklift into a water pipe in the wall. And all of a sudden, of course, there was... And, you know, these forklifts, they start very fast, right? They don't... They're electric often, and so they have a lot of power. And if you're not used to it, you can bump into things much quicker than you think. So I did that, and it was water coming out of the wall. And then, you know, we didn't know how to turn it off. And so the father came in. He had a cell phone that was great at the time, and he rushed in. You know, he was hiking, and so he was quite mad. And then I think it could have really gone bad, because the water could have, you know, damaged some of the materials that are really expensive and so on. And of course, there's no insurance for the kids driving the
forklift.
So I guess, you know, in the end, it wasn't that bad, fortunately. And, you know, they were understanding, and no big damage. But I really felt bad that day, of course. And then also had to tell my parents and all that. Yeah.
But the band stayed together.
It did.
So it came out okay. Well, again, great question from Mike Okanow. Yeah. and good reminder not to let you drive any heavy machinery.
Yeah.
And then I guess kind of, you know, maybe going chronologically a bit. So a question that you oftentimes ask other people, and Marwan Hariz was particularly interested in asking you, is, you know, your main mentors and influences growing up. Who motivated you to go into the areas that you did, and who had a big impact on your interests and why you became a neurologist and neuroscientist? Yeah.
Great question. And one is sitting right here, and we'll get to that. So, but I did, I always followed the flow. So I, you know, maybe that's also a good thing to say, because maybe looking now at my career, it looks like there was a big master plan, but there really wasn't, if I'm honest. I was quite interested in music, did an MD thesis in Germany. That's a small thesis, in Freiburg, with fMRI and DTI on language and music. So it was a, my part, I'm co-author on that neuroimage paper, so it wasn't, I was really young then, so we should see that more as a master's thesis, kind of small work. But that got me into DTI, and then I thought I really wanted to do 1 year of methods, that sounded like a long time back then, before I went into clinics to go to a real hardcore methods lab, and I...
So this was while you were in medical school?
That was, MD was while I was in med school in Freiburg, and
okay.
I kind of enjoyed the work. I did program a little bit as a kid, basic programming, you know, and then could also do MATLAB programming and wrote some scripts. And then I thought, okay, before I go into clinical practice, I'll do 1 year. And again, that sounded like a long period at the time, to do pure research, to really become a methods person. And then later in residency, I could, you know, maybe continue that. And so I joined a lab in Berlin, which was Felix Blankenburg's lab. He's at the Max Planck Institute there. And it was, you know, it was this type of typical German lab that looked towards London, UCL, with, you know, free energy principle, dynamic causal mapping, PPIs, and all these things in fMRI. So, but I kind of came as the DTI person with global tractography that I learned a bit in Freiburg. And then I think that was a fantastic period where I learned a lot about all these concepts. Although I was too junior to ever understand the free energy principle, I was at least immersed in such an environment, and that was really great. And then Felix's wife at the time was Andrea Kuhn, so I started 1 day a week to work with her at Charité, and her lab was the EFIS focused lab. So I was the imaging sidekick there, and to localize electrodes. And I think back there was a guy before me who did that, Thomas Schönecker, who was fantastic, but unfortunately left academia. And he manually clicked on the electrodes in Slicer and taught me that. And, you know, we localized lots of electrodes manually, and we always dreamed of a more automatic solution.
So this was a 3D slicer?
That was already 3D slicer back in the day, yeah.
So this is the days before Lean DBS.
Yes, exactly. And so I think I learned a lot then from Andrea, you know, with DBS, and that really got me hooked on to DBS. And then I think I always had the fixed idea to one day live in New York in my life. And I think at the time the cool kids at the HBM were, you know, Cameron Craddock and Dan Margulies and Pierre Bellec, and they were my, you know, I found them super cool, and then and they still are super cool, of course, and went to these hackathons and so on. So I loosely had a plan with Cameron Craddock to go to New York City for half a year or a year, and wanted to try to get some funding. But then I think OHBM in Hamburg happened, and I showed a poster, and a guy named Mike Fox came to it, and essentially we got to talk, and I think it was the Lead DBS poster, and it was at the end of a hall, and I sneakily pulled a bistro table close to it and could show the Lead DBS toolbox, I think, also on and then I met you, and you were fantastically interested at the time, and, you know, so inspirational and so enthusiastic, and I think we got to talk and met again in San Diego at the Movement Disorders conference, and then I think you know, in a way, you just made it sound much more attractive to go to Harvard than to New York, and so I,
I owe Cameron Craddock a huge apology at some point.
I think he's fine. I think our first kind of collaboration was your PNAS 2014 paper, where only in the supplementary material you they made you show DTI tracks as well. And I think I even mentioned in the acknowledgements there too, because we had normative connectomes in structural connectivity there. And so I think that then coming to Boston really was, for me, the big deal in my career, 100%, as a postdoc, right? It was the first time I moved over twice. You know, learning from you, we only, I think, wrote two papers together where I'm proper first author and you're proper last author. We have much more, I think, as collaborations, of course, but I think I learned so much in these two papers. One was in human brain mapping, one in Annals of Neurology, and just the way you, you know, you think big picture science, how you write as well, how you frame things, how... And then I think also I remember that I was, you know, in Boston with you, I think 1.5 years or so, and the I always thought, okay, in Germany we would have already submitted this, but I learned that if you wait a little bit more and, you know, make a bigger story out of it, it's much more fun. And you know, so I feel like that was something where I learned more this, you know, trying to go the extra mile, trying to add another tangent to the story. And so that fundamentally helped. And then when I went back to Germany, founded my own group, that I always thought, you know, I also talked to people about Mike said or Mike would say and so on. So I really recognized how much I learned from you. So I think if there's a single person, I really must, and I'm not saying this because you're here, but I really think...
Here's the money I paid you in advance for this interview. Most of the quotes that you probably attribute to Mike Fox actually came from Mark Raichel or Alvaro Pascalion or many of my mentors. Oh, now that I know your life's dream is to actually go work in New York, I think it's only appropriate that the next question comes from Helen Mayberg.
Okay.
And Helen, if you're listening, no, Andy does not want to go to New York anymore. but actually, Helen wants to know, in your development, you mentioned Andrea Kuhn as being such an important mentor of yours,
yeah,
who taught you so much. Did you ever consider becoming a functional neurosurgeon? And, you know, if not, you know, what dissuaded you from doing functional neurosurgery?
Yeah, great point. And I should highlight Andrea more. So I spent most of my, you know, time as a postdoc with her, and I learned a lot. And she also gave me a lot of opportunities. So I think I probably moved too fast. So Andrea, of course, is the other very big mentor for me, and was fantastic to work with her. And, you know, had so much opportunity in Berlin also to grow and to develop things. And so it's a good question. Again, I think I'm, you know, I'm sometimes late in my thoughts in life, and I even now only sometimes thought it could have been cool to become a neurosurgeon, but I never even saw the possibility maybe in the beginning. You know, my dad's an eye doctor. I was always, you know, more on the maybe conservative side of medicine growing up, and becoming a surgeon just seemed out of my, I don't know, comfort zone probably, but I never even considered it. It wasn't that, and then sometimes in hindsight, I think I should have thought more about these things, right? I'm actually glad I did not become a surgeon. It's a huge challenge, right? It's very hard, especially here in the States, but also in Germany. It's, you know, a lot of work. And then also, I would say, it's a lot of time where you cannot do science, right? So I think... Some people, like John Ralston, does a great job, I think, or Mark Richardson, to combine things. But that's a unique setup, I think, they have. And so for most neurosurgeons, I think that it's tough to carve the time out to do proper research. And that's really what fascinates me most. So I love collaborating with surgeons, of course, and also trying to be in the OR every now and then and so on. But it's funny, I interviewed Marie Kruger in the podcast, and she went to med school with me, and she's now a functional neurosurgeon in London together with Ludwig Sinjo and Harith Akram and so on. And when talking to her, you know, we do similar things now, but also very different things, right? She's the one putting the electrodes in and then gets to stop the tremor, and that must be very rewarding. So I sometimes think in a second life, maybe I would consider it, but
still time.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna, well, maybe before I ask, there's one question that was the number one most popular question asked by multiple people, but I'll wait on that one before we get to. Tell me a little bit about your time in Berlin when you moved back and you were first starting your lab and you had to think through, you know, what do I want to focus on? How am I going to differentiate myself? What's going to be, you know, my identity as a PI? And take me back to that time period and how did you decide to focus on what you focused on and you know, you become the connectomic DBS guy?
Yeah. Thanks. So I left Boston 2017, like my first period in Boston, back in Boston now, obviously, but after a really fun postdoc with you. And I think I mainly left that early because I really still wanted to finish up residency. So that was, you know, the main reason that where I felt like I have to go back to, you know, get that done. In the end, I never did, but I started slowly also with clinical practice, but Andrea also lured me into doing another half a year or so in research. And then I wrote a grant that is, you know, a bit like a K award, I would say. It's probably for independence. It's a nice setup once you get it. It gives you 6 years of full pay and I think one or two postdocs on top. So it's really a great grant to start your lab. It's called the Eminuta program. And I fortunately got that and I got to, found a lab, a small lab. And so that grant essentially paved the way. It had these themes of having maybe two targets to treat the same symptom, such as SDN and GPI for Parkinson's. Are they, you know, connected to the same network? But then also the same target for different symptoms, like that's only now published, but we're still back from that time, the SDN project of, you know, multiple disorders, really try to spin this connectomic DBS idea from various angles using structural and functional connectomes, but also trying to, see how can it bridge across DBS targets, how can we better understand the networks involved and so on. So I think that was probably really still very much inspired from our work together, paving back then the next 6 years. I only made 3 years in Germany and came back and stopped essentially that project again. But
And so with those kind of intellectual goals in mind, why did you decide to build your own software program to go after those? And, you know, you mentioned that there was software available like 3D Slicer. And so what was the motivation behind Lee DBS? Why did you have to build your own thing as opposed to use existing software?
Good question. I mean, it was really tedious work that we did in 3D Slicer. We clicked on every single contact. So, you know, probably there are much better ways to do that, even in Slicer, than we did. And the first idea was to make it automatic, which you still think we should achieve. And so I also thought that, and very much so. And even the first name of Lee DBS was called eAuto, which is, in German, it's an electric car, right? Auto is car. So I don't know, it's a silly name, but it was for electrode auto, automatic electrode, whatever. And that is still a remnant in the code. You see all these EA scripts there that are still from that very early name. And then before we published it, we switched it together with Andrea, I think, to Lee DBS. So the idea was that I think, first of all, to make it simpler, that process that we did so much. And then I think once I started building it, the more interesting stuff was actually the visualization. So I realized, you know, the idea was to localize the electrodes automatically, but then there was also no great way of visualizing them. And even the very simple, crappy ones where we just had a line with four dots but maybe a 3D thalamus or something, that was already so insightful and helpful for papers and so on. So that grew and was fun to make it prettier and prettier, and, you know, add shading and all these things. And I remember also just even carving out or plotting the segments was, you know, I learned all that the hard way. I had to Google a lot on how to do these things, and also, you know, made many detours as always. But I mean, there was no real alternative at the time. I even remember going up to Chris Butson at one talk once and asking him, you know, is there some way to use his software? And then I also emailed Cameron McIntyre to use Cicerone, I think, which they had. But, you know, was a small guy back then, I think, didn't get a reply. Even told him that recently as well. which of course is very normal, right? If some random person shoots you an email, you often don't have the time to reply. But that was the reason. There was really no alternative. And I think Cicerone was at the time already sold to Boston Scientific as well. So I think that was probably the reason.
So what you're saying is that you didn't build LeadDBS just for cover art?
Yeah, well, it innovation, right? And I think then the next thing, right, at some point we needed a VTA model, because then, you know, Volker Koenen, I think, visited us and he had a simple VTA model and then thought, okay, we need that too. And then, you know, I think Ning-Fei Li joined the teams early on and he added a lot of normalization functions. We started off with the SPM ones and he added ANTS, which was a big, I think, improvement. And I think also FSL, which, you know, just for completeness, we also have in there. And so we just built upon. And then I think at some point we thought, okay, now we have to run stats on, you know, on these groups. So, I kind of built this lead group tool in maybe a weekend, and it also feels that way. It's not great software. For the users that know that would probably agree, but it still kind of works and does a job. And then, you know, I think more and more the team grew, and then we came up with these sweet spot explorers and network mapping explorers and so on. So you know, one thing led to another, but there wasn't this big master plan, I think, in the beginning. Yeah, that's also a nice story that LeadDBS really was a weekend project. It was not my proper project from Andrea at the time. I was looking at networks in Estonia, I think, never published. But that weekend project kind of then became bigger. And I think there were even parts, time points where I felt like this is not going anywhere. And she was the one to motivate me and, you know, keep me up with it. So we certainly owe to Andrea as well to keep it alive at the time. Because it was not an easy thing to, yeah, with especially the hope to make it automatic.
So I guess this now brings me to the most popular question, which was asked by Nikan Dosenbach and Marwan Hariz and multiple other people, which is, you know, leaving this great setup at Charity in Berlin, you know, you're on fire, you got LeadDBS working, you're doing great research, and then you came to Boston. And so comparing and contrasting, you know, the differences of working in Berlin and in Europe versus in Boston,
yeah,
what motivated you to leave your great setup, and what's been the biggest differences between those two environments for you?
That's not an easy question. I even thought maybe this could come up, and I thought maybe I should do a, because I love living in both countries, I could do a roast for both. That's probably not a good idea to do this. No, I mean, it was really a great setup in Berlin. I had, you know, a 6-year timeline and, you know, clinical opportunities. And I think I had a future in Charity and good support there. But I don't know, I think, so there were several reasons, and it was not an easy decision. But one big reason really is you as a mentor. I that is not, you know, again, because you're sitting next to me, but it's really the case. You remember we organized this Radcliffe symposium and in Boston. So that was, I was already in Berlin, but I flew in for that. We jointly organized a small meeting on, you know, Connectomic DBS, I think. And at the time we had STN and GPI DBS as a project that was later published by Leon Sobieski in Brain, and just pitching you the current problems and getting some of the feedback was so helpful, right? Where I thought, oh, I should, you know, do this more with you. And that has become, you know, has been really, really helpful. We I think we, to some degree, think very similarly about the same concepts. And of course, you influenced me a lot. That was one thing. Then, of course, it's an adventure. So also my wife thought, you know, this could be a fantastic adventure. She'd never been to the US, so, and we couldn't even visit because of COVID, so she actually moved for the first time visiting the US.
Oh, wow.
So that was courageous, and she was even pregnant, so, you know, big kudos to her. But it was not that she came for me or so, she really wanted to, and it was a mutual decision. But it was a, as you remember, I think a long evolving thing of, you know, we were sometimes leaning to Boston or to Berlin. We also had a really nice flat in Berlin. Julian Neumann now lives there with Roxanne, so I mean, they took it over. And I sometimes see pictures and think, ah, that was fantastic. It was a winter garden, at, you know, beautiful place. So it was a good setup. But then it's also, of course, a fantastic opportunity to work at Harvard. And Harvard professorship or associate professorship is, of course, a unique thing that I always thought, if I don't do this and then turn 50, I would probably always think back of, you know, what could have done, what could have been when doing this. Joining your center, you know, the mission of the center is fantastic. So maybe for the listeners that don't know, Mike Beals Center, in between neurology, psychiatry, and neurosurgery and neuroradiology, to really bridge things with maybe the connectome as the glue in between things, right? To even learn from TMS for depression, to then also apply similar concepts to DBS for Parkinson's disease. And I think unique in your center is also the aim for translation, which also was for me the next step. So maybe I should add that at that time I kind of decided against practicing medicine long term and really wanted to focus only on research, but that also was not an easy decision. So I you know, moving to your center kind of was in between, where I felt like I could do research that was still meaningful and still, you know, potentially would have impact on patients' lives and so on. So, and I love Boston as a city. You know, it's beautiful in summer, the beaches, it's at the sea, it's, you know, it's, it has so much, so many fantastic opportunities of talks by Nobel laureates all the time. There's MIT, there's Harvard, and there's, you know, MGH, Martino Center, and so on. So it was a fantastic opportunity. But yeah, it was really not a very clear, easy decision, because Berlin was also great setup. So yeah.
So I want to ask you a couple of questions about the podcast itself. Okay. So take me back to the time where you decided to launch the Stimulating Brains podcast, and what was the motivation behind that?
Great question. So I did get into podcasts. I think Friederike Ehrmann, who also has a paper with me together, she got me into podcasts and listening to podcasts. And you know, I just realized this is fantastic, because you can, you know, listen to podcasts. It's a cool medium. You can listen to them while running, you know, while commuting, while maybe even in the shower or whatever. And so while not using your eyes, essentially, for knowledge. And so I then discovered this great podcast called Brain Inspired by Paul Middlebrooks. I think a lot of people would know it. And that was the first one that felt like really in-depth and more meant for scientists and not so much for lay audience, where you know, it's also in-depth, usually 2 hours long interviews where it really goes into the matter and you actually learn stuff. And I loved that podcast. And I always thought it would be so cool to have something like that for DBS. Or for neuromodulation or brain stimulation. And then it was really an experiment, because I always felt like I should not have the time to do this. You know, I should not. Also, I don't want to be the person with the microphone. I want to be a researcher myself. Right? I had serious doubts of how would people perceive me doing this long term, because I would, you know, maybe then I'm not a scientist anymore, but a reporter in a way, right? So I had these thoughts about that. And but I, you know, I'm, like you, I think I often just try to run experiments. And if you listen to the first episode that was with Christian Moll, I really say that this is an experiment and, you know, we'll see. And then, you know, it was, I think when I had 10 or so episodes in, I at the OptoDBS conference in Geneva, and they have this steamship, and I was talking to Julian Neumann and Aaron Dittes. And it was about some, you know, scientific problem. And then I realized I'm quoting people in this discussion. You know, I might be now quoting Maylon DeLong that I just talked to, or, you know, Hagai Bergman or so in this, maybe it was about basal ganglia loops. And I just realized how much I learned from just talking to people like that, right? It's a whole lifetime for them to integrate information, and you kind of get the condensed juice. You have to, you know, you don't get the raw material, so you have to essentially take it or leave it. So it's a different form of knowledge, I think, that you learn from others. But it is a very interesting, you know, and knowing that, for example, Maylon thinks it that way is very helpful information for me. You know, it doesn't need to be right. It could also be wrong. He could be wrong. But it's still, it's very hard to come to a similar understanding by just reading papers especially historical ones. So at that point, I realized, okay, this should be worth my time. And I even, you know, maybe us as scientists should do this more in a way, right? Because I think everybody always says this at the conferences, the discussions are the most interesting part sometimes, not the talks, right? And then there's never enough time for discussion. And in a way, this is a format where you carve out 2 hours, and that's always very tough for people to carve out 2 full hours. But you really get into talking about something, and then I think for the listeners, it's, you know, they probably do it while commuting or jogging and so on, so they don't lose as much time, I feel. But I don't know. So it's been really rewarding as a bottom line. And the main reason I do it is because I learn. So I would even do it without posting the podcasts online, but I think then I wouldn't be able to convince guests.
And so I guess after, 50 episodes at this point, hopefully the result of the experiment was a positive one. And like any good experiment, the answer is, and now we'll motivate further experiments.
Yeah.
And so for the next 50 podcasts, anything you plan to do differently? Or are you just going to continue same trends?
Great question. I mean, I don't even know if it's a wise thing to disclose this, but I've loosely started, because it might never happen, but I loosely started writing, condensing some of the things I learned into some sort of book format, including the anecdotes, but also the scientific insights. And I've, just done that loosely on the side, so it might happen, might not ever happen, can't promise anything. Also, of course, quite busy now with kids and everything, but what changed there was that at some points, when I tried to create a narrative, there was a missing link somewhere between maybe two things. And then I thought, okay, for that, I should interview this person. And then, so maybe now the book sometimes drives who I invite, because that might be the gap to fill the hole in a way, right? So that's maybe one thing. I try to, for myself, use this to answer bigger questions somehow. Or not answer them, but at least get some glimpse of an insight. That's a downside, right? It's not hard science, of course, if you talk to people, right? It's not a reliable source of information. But yeah, again, it's this high level, big picture type of information. So yeah.
And it sounds like a motivation is you're trying to weave together these insights and experiences that you've gotten from the different people that you've spoken with, and by speaking with so many different people, you start to identify gaps.
Yeah.
And I guess as you integrate across these, 50 luminaries, I continue to be amazed by the people that you've interviewed on the podcast. That's why it's one of my favorite podcasts. But as you start to integrate the principles that you've learned, anything that's emerged as common elements across all these successful people that have worked on stimulating brains, things that would be... I always like that you end the podcast by, lessons for the younger generation. And you hear similar advice from different people, but I'd like to hear, how are you weaving the story together? How do you integrate the advice and experiences of these 50 people?
I think it is very hard, right? Because with everybody has their story, and they might not overlap. So there's probably not one or two big themes that always come up. But across at least always a pair of maybe 3 or 4 speakers, you can often build stories, right, that make a bigger pattern. One thing that's, as a big question that interests me a lot, that I maybe don't get to investigate myself so much with the methods we're using in the lab, is this idea, and we've talked about this a lot too, about deep brain stimulation can sometimes be, acting as a lesion, but also acting as some sort of excitatory or upregulating information. And I've started writing a bit about that, with eloquent parts of cortex and maybe the more, darker parts of cortex that if you stimulate, you don't see an apparent thing, but probably there's a lesion type effect. So I find that very interesting. If you stimulate motor cortex, you see something. If you stimulate essentially the inputs and the outputs of the brain, the brain seems to perceive that, or the muscles perceive that. So there seems to be a more analog type of information processing there, but then in the higher order cortices and maybe Penfield's centroencephalic system, that's more oscillatory and so on. There, things are different. There, maybe DBS more acts like a lesion, at least high frequency DBS acts like a lesion. So I've, you know, then tried, for example, for a bigger question like that of, you know, where does this translation between maybe these types of the brain or parts of the brain change, or so I then try to maybe invite people that could help me answer that a bit better, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, then the other big question or big motive that I'm really fascinated by, we often talk of cortical columns as a unit in the cortex, but maybe if you see the wiring diagram of a cortical column to also project to the basal ganglia, to the cerebellum, to the brainstem, and then thalamus and back in a way, maybe that's the unitary circuit or the basic circuit of the brain that's then multiplied a lot across the cortex and across the brain. And so that's something that I find really fascinating of, you know, basal ganglia cortical interactions, and then also try to use the brilliant minds of the interview partners to gain insight on that. So that helped me to direct the questions I ask sometimes, and also the people I invite. So these bigger questions, I think there are some really fantastic things to weave things together. You know, from maybe Helen Myberg, who was in episode number 2. Thanks for that, Helen, because that was really early on trusting the concept. And Marwan was number 3, I think. So that again was, you know, fantastic. So to have these big names come in that early. You know, from Helen to then Andres Lozano's work, you know, with Fornix DBS and these things. And there again, we talked a lot about that. And then I found it really interesting to talk to both Anne Young and Melon DeLong, who were maybe in these, you know, in the Albin DeLong model. There was these two groups at the time, and hear their experiences of what they contributed to this bigger basal ganglia circuit model. And I don't know. In terms of, for example, the last question of career advice, everybody's a bit different, right? We often hear something like follow your passion, which I think is great advice, but, you know, everybody only seems to get one answer, and they pick different things, but it's always really great to hear what they say. So,
yeah. And I guess just an open-ended question about the podcast, right? Anything that listeners, you know, don't know but should about the origin of the podcast, about what you mm-hmm. learned, about what's coming next?
Oh, good question. I mean, I'm very open to any type of feedback, right? So that's, please approach me. I'm also very open to any type of help. So I should maybe at this point also mention two fantastic students that did reach out to me that are not from my lab. That's Ala Taha from Canada and Niels Pacheco, who actually works in John Ralston's lab. They think both listened to the podcast and kind of emailed me and offered help to produce episodes, which is fantastic. And they've, you know, just interacting with them as well, they have sometimes great ideas of maybe who to invite. And, you know, maybe I think Allah has done a lot on website too, where he could integrate, you know, I think he's now looking at ways to also have a transcript that he could maybe Google and make the podcast more accessible to that. And so I'm, you know, very open to any types of suggestions, whom to invite, what to talk about, what to change, what is annoying, maybe the audio quality is not always best, you know, these things, please do approach me if you want. And any type of help is great. I think I always wanted this to be a platform for others as well, that, you know, if somebody wants to interview somebody, you know, please reach out. We had guest episodes before where, you know, for example, Julian Neumann interviewed Aysegul Gündüz and some other examples. And I always hope that maybe these similarly, you know, mid-career researchers might join in and even make this a bigger thing, because, you know, some people could be interviewed better by others. They sometimes don't know their work. But then so far, nobody has really bitten. It's a lot of work, right? You have to be really committed to this. But if there's anybody listening that would like to join the team, that would be great. Because it really is just a hobby for me, and a great one. But yeah,
I can say I've very enjoyed the experience of being a guest host and interviewer.
True, you're right. Yeah,
so it's been a lot of fun. But and then I've intentionally avoided any kind of details about your science. I think a lot of people are familiar with your work, with the papers you've published, and so I focus more on you and the story behind you and your ideas, but maybe just a couple questions about your science. You know, what has been your favorite piece of science that you've done to date, and why is that the favorite piece of science that you've done?
Oh, great question. I think three things stick out. One would be also the paper we did in Annals, just because it was the first bigger project for me, and also the first maybe connectomic DBS in a way, using normative connectomes. It was, to me, I see this as a proof of principle that this could work, and we were, I think, maybe even among the first to cross-estimate outcomes across surgeons and centers, and that I think was really great. And then I think one big success story is Ningfei Li's tracked model for OCD, where that was a serendipitous discovery. We were looking at so we had published a paper, and maybe that was even the first in there with Carlos Balderman, who looked at ALIC DBS cohorts, and we used a novel technique at the time that we call fiber filtering, where we could identify which tracts associate with clinical improvement, and that was ALIC DBS, so anterior limb of the internal capsule for OCD, and a specific tract came out that was published in BioPsych. And then Ningfei was actually in the middle of writing, he was working as first author on what was recently published by Barbara Holunda in Nature Neuroscience, this STN project where we looked at different STN electrodes, and it was already back in, I don't know, 2019, so a long time ago. That was usually originally Ningfei's project, and we looked at the OCD cohort of that, and out came the exact same track that Carlos just had published, but it was from the STN.
Mm-hmm.
And so we essentially dropped the bigger project and said we have to follow up on that, because it was really a surprise finding. It said it can't be, this is the same thing, and you know that must be relevant. And then you know we essentially shifted and pivoted to that story. And so what Ningfei could show then is that individually with subthalamic DBS and also capsular DBS, you could identify the same tract in a data-driven manner, but independently from one another, and you could even cross-estimate improvements across these DBS targets. And that was then published at some point, and I think why I find it so exciting is that it has then been replicated quite a few times by others, and you know that of course is very rewarding, because it, you know, you could always be wrong of course too, but this one really seems to hold true. You know, we've shown it over and over again recently, also with Samir Sheth in a blinded fashion. So that kind of storyline, I think there are maybe four papers now around this tract in a way, and also some by others. Helen Myberg's team or Martin Figi's team in New York were the first to replicate it or validate it, and then Phil Mosley did in Australia. And I think, you know, by now we even have started using it in a way clinically at MGH, at least to co-inform the surgeons, and then also in a prospective trial in Brisbane by Phil Mosley that and the team there to, you know, prospectively target this tract and this network for OCD. So I think that is probably the single most successful or, you know, yeah, serendipitous discovery that kind of took off and replicated. And yeah,
I'm gonna interrupt you there, but because one piece you didn't emphasize, but that story of the OCD tract and how it was able to be replicated and cross validated across so many different groups internationally, can you say a little bit about your thoughts on open science and using Lead DBS as a distribution platform that allowed that to be possible?
So we had a preprint of that paper out, I think probably even a year at least before it got accepted at Nature Comms. It was a long, you know, it was even a, you know, reject and rebuttal kind of situation at the journal. So it took ages. I think the editor left in the middle, and then, you know, we really waited a long time. So it took a long time to get published. So in that whole time, there were a few groups that read the preprint and were interested in it. And then I think once it was published, we made the tract itself openly available within Lead DBS, so everybody can download that. It's called, I think, OCD Response Tract. You named that, by the way, I think. great naming. But so everybody can essentially download it and, you know, in theory, look at their own cases with DBS for OCD for whatever target and measure the overlap of their stimulation and then, for example, correlate that with clinical improvements in their cohort, right? And I think that's exactly what, I think the first was Martin Figuier's group, Smith et al. In brain stimulation did, and they had 10 more cases. They just measured how much is the published tract being stimulated in each and how does that correlate with the Y-box improvement. And that was significantly positive. I mentioned the preprint because there were four studies that supported this finding within 6 months' time. And probably that was because the preprint was already there. Because probably nobody's that fast usually to get things together and from the idea to publication. But I think people started looking at this before the paper was even out. Maybe to answer your question, I really believe there in open science and making that available, because if you just show the picture of the tract, nobody can quantitatively replicate it. But if you make the data set open, then everybody can do that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people do, you know, put their data on, you know, NeuroVault or try to provide a open access resource for the maps that they generate.
Yeah.
But I think there might be something unique about providing that resource on the same software platform mm-hmm. that people are using to process their data anyway. You know, I've often wondered if, you know, if FSL and SPM are directly linked to NeuroVault or more integrated. And
yeah.
But to me, I've always loved that story as, you know, how do you get your, not just your paper out, but
yeah.
but the result out in a way people can use the result, not just look at a picture of the PDF.
It's a great question. I never thought of that. It's a great idea, actually, to, you know, you could very much envision that people had used whatever Connectome Workbench or SPM or what people are using now to do these things, that they can in the software directly say compare with NeuroSynth or NeuroVault, or I think NeuroSynth has a decoder or so, right? So there are these fantastic resources, but you're right, they are not integrated. I mean, it's more, you know, we didn't think of that. It was just that we had LeetDBS and we could add it as an atlas, so it was more not born from a thought like you just had, but just because that's the easiest way for us to distribute the data. But maybe I could also answer there that LeetDBS is an open book for people to add data, of course, and to also add code and, you know, to help us. This is also meant to be a public resource from scientists for scientists, so everybody can reach out and, you know, we are on GitHub and you can add data and atlases and see this as your platform to add your own tools or code or add plugins or whatever. So we're always very open for that.
And then with the OCD story, are you aware of any negative findings, right? So once the track's available, anybody can localize
yeah.
their electrodes and see intersection. Obviously, anybody that does replicate the finding is going to submit that for publication,
yes.
and it lowers the barrier for them to be able to do that.
Yeah.
You know, have you ever found out about people that have tried to replicate it and couldn't, and have they still been able to publish that negative finding?
That's a really good point, and it might be a real problem, right? Because it's a tough thing to say, hey, we found this track does not work, right? And then you go maybe against these other four papers, and so it might in part be driven by selection bias, which would of course be horrible. I mean, I try to learn from whoever shares their insight with me from the clinical teams worldwide. I always want to exactly know the failures, right? We can learn much more from those. So, you know, we did a few cases in MGH where I was even partly involved and, you know, visited when the programming happened with Darren Doherty. And so they would usually seem to check out really well. On the other hand, it's also sometimes, you know, it is not in psychiatric DBS. It's not an exact science in a way, of course, right? Sometimes there's also great response in if you stimulate the nucleus accumbens, which in a way our papers show would lead to improvement, but not to as much improvement. Patients are heterogeneous, of course. Everybody has their own very own symptoms. So there was, for example, one case I've seen that had compulsions where they had the person had to do mathematical operations all the time in his head. It was, you know, constantly, even while talking to you, apparently he was doing maths, right? You could ask, is that a compulsion or is that an obsession, right? Probably it's a compulsion, but it's not really an action. It's more a thought, right? So it's probably maybe something in between in a way. So that just shows me, or these case examples show me how different people can be. And then, of course, it's not surprising that there will be examples where modulating this tract is not the best solution for them, right? It's still an average finding on an average group level, and every brain is wired slightly differently and so on.
And then I guess, you know, obviously you get a lot of press recently about a new Nature neuroscience paper that just came out, where you looked at, you know, different disorders that are all treated with STN-DBS.
Yeah.
And I think you coined a new term, a dysfunctome.
Yeah.
As part of that. So maybe walk the listeners a bit through that piece of science and what you think the implications of that paper are.
Thanks. So I think that was exactly the paper that Ningfei dropped when we found the OCD track. So that shows how long this has been going on, and was also still part of that first grant I had in Germany. So it took ages, and then, you know, big kudos to Barbara Hulunda, who essentially took it over from Ningfei and did a fantastic job. You know, she's, she's unique. And Ningfei also, of course, she's shared last author. I think it was also shared first in a way, but did a lot of the analysis. And so the two are a fantastic couple there to work on that power, not couple, but, you know, power team duo. So the idea there is to, you know, it always struck me STN-DBS can lead to symptom improvements in very different disorders, Parkinson's, dystonia, Tourette's, and OCD, and even, you know, sometimes addiction. There's one case, I think, published, Huntington's disease. We had one great case in Charité that really was fantastic. And so, you know, various disorders with this whole, you know, same nucleus that's a centimeter long in the depth of the brain. How can that be? Is it all placebo, right? You would think. And of course, we knew already before that paper that, especially for OCD, we would target the more anterior parts of, or more ventral parts of the STN. And for the motor disorders, I think the target's more similar. Some would also, for Tourette's, even target more anteriorly. So there's a slight difference in targeting. But we wanted to show in a more data-driven way to look at, are these different networks of the same kind of cortical basal ganglia thalamocortical system. And it was also a big honor to have Malin DeLong and Hage Bergmann on the paper. So after talking to Malin on the podcast, I, you know, also sent him this manuscript. And because in a way it ties back to their original Alexander et al. Paper, but now shows it a bit more data-driven, maybe, and based on DBS. And so the idea with this dysfunctome, if I'm honest, came very late in the process. So the tracts that we identify that correlate with symptom improvements might be exactly the tracts that are disrupted in a given disorder, and that we then have to lesion or tune down to improve the symptom. For example, I think in Parkinson's, the story is most well-known with alleviated beta power activity. There's some sort of overactivity of the STN loop in that, and that seems to cause problems, and then tuning that down either by a lesion seems to improve the circuit. So these causal sources of information that also you published a lot on, and, you know, I took that story, of course, from you and Shan, where the idea is to use causal sources of information to identify which circuits play a role. You know, we thought, okay, now the reviewer put into our mouth exactly what we already think. Now we have the liberty to actually put it in at scale. And we changed a lot of the narrative in the introduction and said, dysfunctional circuits can potentially be identified with DBS and with network mapping. And then I thought, okay, we now kind of start doing it at scale with these four disorders. And so that's a bit like the, you know, connectivity versus connectome. The difference is that you map it into a sort of library. And so we came up with this term. I don't know if it's going to stick, but I kind of like the idea that we use, you know, causal sources of information to map the dysfunctome of the human brain.
Got it. I guess a related question on that line of thought comes from Ben Steckler, which is, you know, if you are able to use DBS or some other type of causal mapping resource to figure out where a dysfunctional circuit is, and it sounds like it's the assumption is the circuit that you need to stimulate to make someone better is also the circuit that's dysfunctioning.
Yeah.
That might be true, might not be true. But Ben's question was, you know, how different are these dysfunctional circuits going to be across two different individuals with the same disease but might have slightly different symptoms?
Great question. Thanks, Ben. And I think that is exactly the next step. And there's one bigger paper as well in review where we look at just Parkinson's now, but symptom-specific circuits. So essentially segregating that loop, it's the same, you know, part of this frontostriatal interactions that is in there, but we can further segregate it towards symptoms. And that's still on a group level, right? But there, for example, this is work by Nandita Rajamani. I think there's posters already been published, you know, hopefully soon also a paper where we could show that slightly different parts of that loop are more predominantly associated with improvements of specific symptoms such as tremor, bradykinesia, rigidity or axial symptoms. So I think, and we actually do the same for OCD too. Barbara Holunda's taking up that, and you know, we have tons of fantastic collaborators that shared data with us where we could also further segregate that Lee circuit, you know, the OCD response circuit, that's, you know, that part of that too, into obsessions, compulsions, anxiety and depression. So with the hope to maybe use that for personalization of DBS at some point, where maybe, you know, especially in the ALIC, it's beautiful, it's really along the trajectory line where you could, with different contacts, if this holds true, predominantly stimulate specific symptoms better than others. And again, that's, you know, for Ben, I know how Ben thinks, this is still on a group level, right? This would still be group level tremor tract or group level bradykinesia tract. And it's going to be very hard to map that, I think, on the individual level, because we need a group to do statistics, right? We have to essentially, it's very hard in a single brain to understand what is the tremor circuit. That might be possible at some point, but
you can imagine with enough different contacts and directionality in VTAs,
that's true.
You could turn a single patient into a large enough data set to run statistics on just that one patient.
It's a good point, and I think we've, you know, thanks to Till Dembeck, who visited us here, he shared a data set with us, and in Anditha's paper, we were able to do that to some degree at least, right? So it's a great point, stimulating different contacts. You could then run statistics across the same brain in a way. Yeah, that would be fantastic to do too. Yeah.
So you've already alluded to where you're going next, especially, you know, in the near future. So papers that are in preparation or going, you know, making their way through the peer review process. But maybe jump out, you know, 5-10 years into the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of Kai Miller's questions that I thought was good was, if you were given infinite resources,
okay,
right, to get where you think the field needs to be in 10 years,
yeah,
right, what would you do with those infinite resources? How would you get where you think the field needs to go?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. I tried to answer a similar question for some conference. Infinite resources is such a big ask, where I think at that point, if it's really infinite, I would try to probably go towards neuroprosthetics to kind of try to replace these circuits or build them and rebuild them in silico and essentially try to modulate, you know, replace a broken basal ganglia circuit with something, a device, and then patch it in. But that's really, you know, infinite resources. So maybe more realistically,
that's not that far off of what Elon Musk is doing.
He's the closest
person I know that have infinite resources.
You're right. Yeah, I think the idea there really to then at some, because I think one big limitation of DBS is, I think, that is currently still quite limited in what it does, right? It tunes down something. And then even adaptive DBS would do that on a temporal scale, right, in a bit more nuanced fashion and maybe more adaptive fashion, but it would still not repair the circuit. It would not, I think, it would not inject meaningful information. It would still put the brakes on in the right time, right, in a way, but not more than that. So I think that's great, but, you know, that's also so far off from what I'm actually doing that I wouldn't be the person to do it, even if I had the resources. So I would probably rather move to the Caribbean with infinite resources. But, I think two things that I find very exciting for the nearer future that are more realistic and maybe more in my ballpark. One is an idea that Julian Neumann had. We have these two big fields now, adaptive DBS and connectomic DBS, kind of emerging as, you know, potentially the next big thing, but they might be united to something like adaptively switching networks that I find really interesting. For example, that we detect tremor in a patient and then in that moment stimulate the tremor network, and we need connectomics for that to define that network, but we need adaptive stimulation to know when to stimulate. And then, you know, if bradykinesia kicks in, it would stimulate that. And of course you could spin that to speech and to gait and to, you know, all these side effects as well, to avoid, you know, when you detect speech, to stop stimulating the speech disturbance network. But maybe sometimes you have to, because that helps tremor. So, right. So to adaptively, because currently adaptive DBS, the idea is really to just have the same contact on versus off. But we could maybe shape the fields in such a way that we simulate networks. The other big thing that I also find very interesting, but that's way more exploratory, and that also is, you know, joint idea with Julian Neumann that we kind of developed over the years but never did, was this idea that these beta bursts that we know are in the broken loop in Parkinson's, they span a time frame of 200 or 300 milliseconds, right? So a longer time frame, and then maybe using very ultra fast fMRI, we could maybe even detect something like that. And the cool thing is, with fMRI, you would know exactly where the broken circuit is, right? If it's possible, because you can go up to even 60 milliseconds with single slice fMRI, and then even with whole brain fMRI, you know, to faster sequences. So that, in my view, could be something, and I don't know if that's possible, but it would be such a breakthrough to be able to see these broken circuits in individuals, because then you would exactly know where to stimulate and where to put the electrode and so on, right? So, and better understand it. But that's a big ask, right? It could be that the hemodynamic function just doesn't allow these fast things to be seen in fMRI, right? But it's at least something where I feel like this could be worthwhile to testing and seeing, yeah.
And I guess, do you worry at all that visualizing those broken circuits, and it reminds me a little bit of all the stereo EEG work that's going on, right?
Yeah.
We're not fMRI, but they're using stereo EEG to try and characterize the broken circuit from an electrophysiological
yeah.
standpoint. But one of the things that's at least worried me is whether using fMRI or the electrophysiology, you're getting a correlate of something that's abnormal.
Yeah.
And it might correlate with the symptom you're trying to treat.
Yeah.
But you still don't know if it's, you know, causing the symptom, compensating for the symptom, incidentally related or a risk
yeah.
factor for the symptom. And so even if you can characterize an individual that dysfunctional circuit from a correlational standpoint, you still don't know until you flip on the electrode whether going
yeah.
after that circuit will actually affect the symptom you want to treat.
It's a really good point. And, you know, again, I love the work you and Sean have put together, and you know, a lot of our motivation builds upon that, to use exactly causal sources of information and not, you know, imaging results. Now you're right. I know with this idea, go back to fMRI imaging. I mean, you could even say the same for beta power. Nobody knows if it's causal for the symptoms, right? I think at the moment, and I think Julian Neumann's usually my hero on that topic. So I usually, that's why I refer to him so much. But he would say probably not. It's more a, you know, a physio marker. So I personally disagree, but it's just a gut feeling. I think it has to do with this noise, you know, this noisy signature that actually disrupts the circuit, and probably just, you know, the proper information doesn't flow anymore, or it even affects other symptoms. So I believe the beta power might be causal, but it's really just a belief. But be that as it may, I think at least we know that by correlative evidence that stimulating the high beta contacts seems to work, right? We've known that way before Percept, I think, in the Kuhn lab, and you know, from the Oxford group and so on. So Peter Brown's fantastic work, and then of course Phil Starr and so on. So I think there's good evidence by now, and really reproducible evidence as well, that beta power correlates with the symptom severity, goes down with dopamine, goes down with DBS. The contact seems to matter that you switch on and so on. So the idea would be to make, you know, see that without an electrode before you put the electrode in, and then it might not matter if it's causal or not, right? Because you know the rough circuit already. You know it has to be something in the thalamocortical loop, but it might be that in some patients it's more M1 and some it's more SMA. Some Parkinsonian patients might even start with more cognitive symptoms or so, right, where maybe more frontal, and so you could just slightly shift where it wouldn't be a new target. It would still be STN, I think. But
But I think what you emphasize is that we already know it is a useful biomarker of where we want to stimulate.
Yeah.
And so if it can identify where and which contact or which segment you want to flip on, then in theory, mapping that biomarker could better inform where you want to stimulate. That makes a lot of sense. So I'm going to follow your model for the other interviews you did and with some rapid-fire questions. And so one of the ones that you asked that I always love is eureka moments, that time where you really felt this is big.
Oh, yeah, great question. One was with you when it worked that we could cross-estimate or cross-predict the improvements from, I think we had a cohort from Berlin and Würzburg there, you know, with the model we had trained on the Berlin data. And then I think the other one was really this moment where I realized that I just described before, oh my God, that's the same tract that, you know, Carlos just published, but it's from a different target. So the OCD story there. And I think, you know, I have smaller eureka moments quite often. That's why I love this job. It's, you know, it's this, we often start off with a project where maybe it's still uncertain, will this be something? And you just have to trust, you know, the project so far have become a story. So we have to kind of follow the, but there are usually young trainees in the line that blindly trust you and you feel like, oh, you know, it could also be the first project that just doesn't work. And so I think there's always this one moment where you kind of made it over the hill where you know, oh, this is going to be a paper, right? Mm. And so I have those every now and then. And that's what I love about the job. It's, you know, solving the puzzle sometimes or solving, finding ways to interpret the data in a good way. And then, of course, you want to replicate it, viewing at things from another angle and so on. But you get a gut feeling, oh, there's a story here. You know, we'll get to something. And I love that about our job. So, yeah.
In any waste of time where you didn't get to that, oh, there's a story here, and you said, oh, that was a waste.
Oh, yeah. I think I had several papers that never made it off the ground that were sometimes put in a year of my postdoctoral life. Maybe not full-time. You know, fortunately, I also had other projects. I remember one where I, you know, tried. That was when I came back to Berlin, and I amassed a huge data set with, you know, different colleagues, I think over 500 patients in SDN-DBS, and tried to map sweet spots for different symptoms. And it just didn't work at the time. And the data was very noisy, poor quality, but I, you know, tried my best to make it work. And with so many patients, you then go back and flip on different, you know, modes. I even, you know, added new methods for that, thought, okay, I should do it this way, I should do it this way. And I think I had a similar project in my PhD time, which was the idea of whole brain psychophysical interactions, so PPI, very different topic that never got published. And I think probably it wasn't a waste of time, but so sometimes you can really grind your teeth on a project, and I had my fair share of that too, I think.
Any additional advice for kind of young investigators or new people entering this field?
So I thought of this one also because I ask everybody, right? And
kind of knew it was coming.
Well, I don't know. I didn't know you would ask it, but I thought every time I ask people, I think, what would I say? And I don't, who am I to tell, right? What to do in life? Life's complex. Everybody has their own, you know, story. And it's very hard to come up with something. But maybe if I had to come up with one thing, I really like the idea to see yourself, but also others, and maybe your trainees, your mentors, and even maybe your enemies, if you have any in the field, as to be fans of them, to put a fan hat on. You know, there's friendship, there's colleagueship, but there's also fandom, and it might sound silly, but I think it's for me, that's a fantastic way of being and of interacting with others, to kind of be excited about whatever they do or whatever you do or what, you know, to kind of have that excitement. And I think I came up, or that dawned on me when I heard an interview with Rick Rubin, who is a famous music producer, when they asked him, what's your secret of being so successful in so many different types of music that you produced? He said, I never stopped being a fan of music. But he didn't see himself as the producer that comes in with, you know, that's how we're going to do it. But no, he goes and sees the band or the you know, DJ or whatever, is a fan of them and says, how can we make this bigger and greater? And to me, it's a very rewarding state of mind where I feel like this is it's a joy to be a fan of people and of other people, even including the people you that might criticize you. It just adds this positivity. And then maybe for trainees, it's even more important, right, to be their fan, to, you know, see them thrive and cheer them on and add positivity. And
I'm now picturing, you know, rather than going to a Taylor Swift concert, you know, Andreas Lozano or Helen Mayberg walking out on stage.
And you aren't cheering. Yeah,
there you go.
That's exactly the picture. Yeah.
Anything that we didn't talk about during this interview that you want to still discuss that we haven't gotten to yet?
No, I think this was great. I mean, this was really a big honor. I mean, maybe I can say I now know what I put people through when I invite them, right?
Well, I can say I've been a big fan
Thank you.
Of Stimulating Brains, and obviously a big fan of you and your work. And so to be able to, you know, express my fanship by honoring you for the 50th anniversary podcast, this was a tremendous honor for me. I'm sure there was a lot of people that would have also loved to be in this chair right now interviewing you.
I don't know if that's true.
Thank you for putting together this podcast, for getting to episode number 50. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you for letting me flip the mic.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much. Great.